Hi, and welcome to the next episode of TransPerfect Lifestyle Talks. I'm Mark White, I'm the Global Practice Leader here at TransPerfect. A while ago, I had a chance to sit down with Dr. Michelle Longmire, and she's kindly joined us again today to do some more unpacking of the Medable story. So, no introduction necessary. Stanford-trained MD, Dr. Michelle Longmire, thank you so much for joining us again at TransPerfect Lifestyle Talks. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks, Mark. Great to be back.
I want to talk about, like, Medable is an e-clinical, very large organization, woman-owned, very impressive credentials. And we talked about in the first episode, we talked about how you got to this point. But now I want you to put on your commercial hat. We're going to take off our science hat slightly, only slightly, and put on our commercial hat, because I'd be interested in, there's a number of things. So let's talk about DCT, because that's a space that both of us live in. So let's talk about DCT for a second. And what you're seeing in the marketplace now, what do you see now as the landscape, the physical landscape now of DCT? Here we are in 2024.
Yeah, so I think, you know, DCT really went from kind of an edge case to a main case, in my opinion, during the pandemic. I mean, the pandemic, it was an existential requirement. When we were doing clinical research, even the investigators were in their own homes for a period of time. I think what happened as a result of that is, you know, we saw this as its own category, but actually it's about the evidence and the outcomes. So what I'm observing now is it's merging with ECOA. And I think what the outward optics might be that DCT is somehow declining, but actually we observe it quite differently. We're observing an increase in the market growth of ECOA, and that the DCT methodology is a core part of the broader evidence strategy. And so I think that it's an exciting and really, like, I think, transformative time for evidence. With that said, we certainly have still seen a shift from fully remote, where everything has to be done remotely, which to me as a physician doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense all of the time, to a more rational and science aligned approach, which is really all about the evidence and the endpoints, how we're going to capture them, how you get high quality outcomes, measurements, and how you actually do that in a way that works for patients and ideally broadens the footprint for patient participation, so you can access historically, you know, underserved patient populations.
I think that's a very fair point. I think that I agree with you that the pandemic pushed us to this, like, extreme DCT desire. And, you know, probably going to rustle a few feathers here, but I do think that technology people loved it and thought, oh, this is great. We have a technology that can do this, rather than saying, well, hold on, it's patient first, technology second. So right. I think there was this rush to, and now this, what I see, and maybe you'd agree with me, is a slight pullback to say, hold on. A hybrid model might be the way forward.
Yeah.
Not everything can be remote, as you rightly say, not everything. So,
yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, it does come down to two things, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we're looking at efficacy of the therapies in large part, and safety. We largely focus on the efficacy part of that. With that said, I think it's then we need to take into account the science that's required to prove or evaluate efficacy, and then the patient experience. And what's exciting is it's not about doing it one way just for the sake of, you know, being able to do it one way. It's really about what is needed for the patient and the science with the broader lens of efficacy and the outcomes we're looking to measure for those patients. So I personally think this is the way the hype cycle goes from all hype to real. And I think this is a really important part of the evolution. And I believe that it will advance evidence generation holistically and make it something not only about being able to access patient populations more effectively, but actually I think the exciting new frontier is really around how we advance the digital endpoints. How can we improve the sensitivity and specificity of certain measures that should be done more digitally, while also facilitating the in-clinic measures that are required, like say a liver biopsy or something that might at this point be best done in a clinic. So, you know, I think that it ultimately comes down to the evidence and the patients and the science needed to evaluate, you know, how we're evaluating the drug in general.
I think that's fair. I think if you look at this to a Gartner bell curve, with the Gartner hype cycle, you know, that's where we are. We are at this kind of like trough of disillusionment,
right?
But we're actually on the way up of it now. So I think you're absolutely right. I think there is this kind of like a reset of like, okay, you know, let's put on our big boy pants here and let's slow this thing down. So let's talk about, like, and I haven't talked to you about this before, so I'm interested when I'm catching you on the fly, but one of the things that I get a lot of is DH, digital health. And we talk about in-home visits and all this good stuff. And you and I haven't talked about this before, but this is now all part of, if you like, a DCT. And I'll give you my opinion. For me, DH is like an elephant. It's massive. How do you eat an elephant? Bit by bit. But it's turned into this colossal patient-centric thing. How does a company like Medible, or any e-clinical company, how do they attack that sheer volume of ways to touch a patient?
Yeah. So, you know, I think one of the kind of silver linings of the hype cycle just getting more real and going from we can do all these things to, like, where are we really going to move the needle on the problem we're trying to solve, which is about clinical development, is that it comes back to the drug label. What is it that we're trying to evaluate? What is it that we need to know to evaluate this particular intervention? So as we focus in on the specific evidence that's needed for this phase 2 or phase 3 clinical trial with the lens of there are a core set of things that must be measured and measured extremely well. And we don't want to layer in unnecessary things that could actually jeopardize the core measurements that are really needed, that we've actually found that, to your point, this is a massive elephant. We can do a lot of things differently, but let's do the core things very, very, very well. Let's make sure we're measuring primary, secondary, exploratory endpoints well. Let's make sure that when we introduce new models of measurement, we're proving that they work and they have parity with the existing measures or are superior. You can do a lot of things, but you've got to come back to the short list of things that need to be done extremely well. And I think be very judicious about adding anything extraneous to that set of requirements, because digital excites people. It makes them want to add a lot of additional, say, sensors. Hey, if we're going to have a blood glucometer, why don't we also have a sleep mat or a scale or you name it? But I think it really is required. We require that we go back to ensuring we can do the core measurements and do them well without adding a lot of site and patient burden. And sometimes digitization, before it's really ready to scale, can actually introduce noise. And so we really just nail in, let's do these three things very well. Let's digitize them. Let's do one or two of them remotely. And let's actually say no to the set of additional requests that we don't think are core to the science.
You took the words right out of my mouth, because where you went with that is, unfortunately, in today's world, we see protocols that are heavily laden and the patient burden is often enormous. We throw in extra questionnaires because we're trying to get secondary points and all that good stuff. And then if you throw in sensors as well, it does increase the burden on the patient. And we all know there's data out there to suggest that the more burden on the patient, the less actual compliant data you're going to get from them. We know that the data compliance falls off. So my thing was, we're getting all this data. And I think you've already alluded to this, but we're getting all this extra data. Why are we doing it? Are we getting data for data's sake? Or are we getting it? Are we getting good usable data that will actually speed up our NDA cycle?
Yes.
Why are we doing it in the first place?
Yeah, and I think that's the huge shift I've seen in the last 24 months, is going from the, you know, all you can eat buffet to the, hey, let's just focus on, you know, these core things that we know, you know, give us our full amino acid profile. It's just a different, more focused approach, because, and we did a retrospective on, you know, sensors can be very powerful. They can provide extraordinary high quality data. What you don't want to do is layer in measurements that you don't need, or that you have so many exploratory endpoints, you're diluting the ability for the site and the patient to focus on the primary, secondary, and maybe a shorter list of exploratory. So yeah, we've seen a much more focused approach be taken. Our teams also give that consultative advice. And I think it comes from the lessons learned of, you know, we need to know that this core capability is focused on, you know, the endpoints that really are important, and you can overload with exploratory endpoints.
That's the whole thing.
Stay very laser focused.
It's I used to when I was in clinic, I used to liken it to a Christmas tree. Everyone wants to hang something on the tree. And by the end of the tree, it's falling over.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. The burden on patients is far too great if we're giving them three questionnaires and then they're worrying. Another question to you is, since you mentioned sensors, sorry, I love your point of view here, but sensors. I did a thing recently, maybe a year ago, and I talked about swimming in data lake. Swimming in a lake of data. The sheer volume of data that we're getting from these sensors, and I know that AI is wonderful. It's wonderful. It can distill some of that data, but it's still a massive bolus. It's an enormous data set that we're trying to. So my question to you is, we're probably going to upset people, by the way, in the sensor world. But anyway, my question to you is that data, that huge data set, are they really useful? Are they really helping the endpoint?
So it ultimately depends on signal to noise. And, you know, I think one of the things I point out is we had a number of partners who were doing continuous monitoring, and we use this in our trials. And when you can solve for the signal to noise, it can be very valuable. But I also reminded people, when you see a patient in a hospital, the only patient who's on continuous monitoring is in an ICU. And the other,
or a halter monitor, certain halter monitor.
Well, sure. I'm just meaning say multi-parameter. But to your point, in general, when you think of the levels of care in a hospital, you know, you've got your floor patients who are getting Q4, Q6, maybe Q8 vitals. But then you're the only patients who are really having multi-vital sign continuous monitoring are those in an ICU. And you think of the team that's around them being able to respond to the signals, the bells. It's a full-time job for multiple people in the hospital.
So
I'd like to point out that that's not valuable to clinicians or to the science if the noise is very, very high and the signal is quite weak. So I think that the opportunity for AI is actually to solve that exact problem. It is to solve the signal to noise. It's part of the reason we have focused to a certain degree on software as a medical device, because the data is so massive that you have to be able to apply algorithms to solve the signal to noise. If you can solve that and do it in a way that you believe is clinically valid, it is clinically validated. Let's not say believe, but you know it's clinically validated, it gets very exciting. We will develop measures for diseases that I truly believe did not think were able to be detected at certain early stages. I think we'll be able to start to detect deviations in homeostasis before we even have manifestation of disease. But we have to solve for the signal to noise, and just an abundance of data really in many cases is more noise than signal.
And a number of these sensor organizations have these algorithms that are they're proprietary, but they have a lot of those algorithms actually targeting that noise in the background. So I mean, I get what you're saying, but is that something that you guys are actively thinking about?
So we have done some very exciting work in digital endpoints. And what we see is that there's a huge opportunity for digital to actually detect off-target effect. So say you're taking a cancer drug and it causes, or say you're doing CAR T and it has cytokine release syndrome, or you have a therapy that causes interstitial lung disease or some sort of pulmonary disease. But that therapy could also be life-saving. How can we detect that off-target effect faster and sooner to treat the patient for that unintended consequence while keeping them on the therapy that is ultimately going to be incredibly, you know, important for their overall health if they're trying to treat cancer or treat a rare form of lung disease or a progressive form of lung disease? So I think that it really is an exciting opportunity to optimize the outcomes of patients on these therapies and to mitigate the unintended effects of the therapies to facilitate clinical intervention earlier.
Okay. I, by the way, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think it has, I think obviously sensors have a point, a place to play in this. I also think that video has a huge, I mean, I was talking on one of the other podcasts before about Duchenne's and how we can video patients getting supine and get patients how they're anchoring themselves. And we can use that data to look at the efficacy of the therapy, and we can look at the regression of the disease. So I'm going to pivot now, if I may. I'm going to pivot for a moment. Because so what I want to talk about is, again, put on your commercial hat, not the science hat, put on your commercial hat. And I want to talk about, as we move towards through DCT, and we're in this trough where we're getting we're growing up the sense of like not everything can be done digitally. How do we scale for that as organizations? Mm-hmm. How do we scale for that? Right now, I think globally, and I could be wrong, I'm going to get hosed for this one, but I think globally, 65% of studies are digital. There still is an awful lot of paper out there. But we're going to have to scale for that. And there's more studies being executed globally than ever before. What's the future? Put on your thinking cap. What's the future for scalability?
So, you know, I think of digital for us, it has kind of three components, and one of them is DCT. So in terms of the value, what we're trying to solve for, speed. We know that getting these therapies to market faster has a huge impact, or even just making a go, no go decision is really important for our partners. So we think about speed, and that's a core area where we're deploying technology and digital. I think that facilitates scaled value. The other is around scale itself. So how do you build an infrastructure that truly can connect with patients all over the world in any geography, in, you know, remote parts of the world, in all, you know, over 100 languages worldwide? And then the third is really where DCT comes in, which is access. How can we also, you know, enable technology to reach historically unmet, underserved populations? So when I think about what the future looks like, it's technology providing speed, scale, in terms of it scaled infrastructure and access to populations who are underserved. In order to do that, you deploy different types of technology or to each of those areas. But scale itself is how can we say go from 65 to 100% of clinical trials leveraging modern technology. And why that ultimately matters so much is that's how I truly believe we are going to bend the time cost curve and how we're going to go from not 50 drugs approved a year, but to 500 without lowering any of the standards. So the scale problem to solve ultimately very important. One of the things that just mind blowing to me is I was, you know, kind of just as I look at the landscape, still almost 90% of dollars go to human services versus technology. And we know that technology provides a type of leverage that we don't get through doing the same thing with, you know, manual processes for years and years. So I think at the end of the day, we have to be more aggressive. We have to be more aggressive in deploying technology in these hard to solve problems of clinical development. And for us, it is about focusing on those speed, scale, and access so that you've got a global infrastructure that can really meet patients everywhere they are.
I think I agree with all of that. There's two points here is that unfortunately humans make errors. Humans make mistakes. So we need to.
And we have limitations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, and as does technology, but like physical limitations, hours of days we can work, you know, numbers of people on Earth.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and in terms of like, and what we do, what the two of us do for a living, we leverage technologies to speed up our trials every day.
Yeah.
I also think you made another brilliant point. The regulators are so focused on diversity now, and rightly so, but they're so focused on diversity, and technology is going to be that enabler.
Yeah.
It's going to allow us to reach patients.
Exactly. And the thing about proper representation of the patient populations in research, it is a moral and a scientific imperative. And I'd say, like, you know, we think about it in terms of different populations, but it's also, we know that these drugs have different, respond differently in different genetic backgrounds, right? We know that. We look at liver metabolism and CYP or CYP. You know, the metabolism of therapies can vary wildly based on one's genetics. So if we're not, you know, really serving the broad patient population that will ultimately take this medication once it's approved, we're really missing the scientific opportunity and requirement of research itself.
I agree with that. I mean, and as a side point, we see that all the time in pediatric rare diseases where with medication, we're using just the same medication. We're just using smaller dosages because they're small people, aren't they? So unfortunately,
it's so imprecise. It's crazy. It's like, okay, you know, here we are in 2024 where I can get on to ChatGPT and have it like dissect, you know, my company performance and give me, you know, advanced graphs on what's going on. And yet our heuristics for human health are just still this kind of finger to the wind broad categorization.
It's true. I think there needs to be we're probably at an inflection point where we need to just pull back ever so slightly and do things for the right reasons. Do things correct for the right reasons. You know?
Right. And I think ultimately like solve the right problems with the right tools and focus on the impact and not on the full set of possibilities, but like what's going to move the needle and how do we really advance clinical development? What is the short list of prioritized problems we need to solve? And then I think that's where you aggressively apply technology.
I think there's, I mean, I agree with that as well, but I think there is.
Not that the list of problems to solve is short.
Not exactly, but I'm going to push back and see sponsors. And I get it. I mean, I came from a sponsor side. Sponsors have invested this enormous amount of money and they want the most bang for their buck. So that's why they put in all these secondary things. And like a Christmas tree, unfortunately, you end up with all these extra add-ons. But I think you're right. I think we need to slow it down and say, what's the most important thing that we're measuring here?
Right.
What's the most important?
I would say, yeah. And it's not even about slow. It's about focus on the
focus.
Yeah. But I think what I've seen for our best partners, that's exactly what they're doing. And one of the cool trends that I think makes so much sense is let's not just think of a clinical trial in a vacuum. Let's think about the therapeutic area. Let's think about the asset. Can we have a technology that is, you know, designed or adapted for that entire suite of research questions we're going to need to ask in that therapeutic area or with that particular drug asset? And I think you get much more leverage and in how you're using technology and how it can benefit the research effort around that therapy, around that, you know, particular domain.
Time is always against us, but Michelle, before you go, I really want you to maybe you've already talked to, but I'd love you just to look into your crystal ball and where do you see us in 5 years in the digital world of clinical?
Well, one, I think digitization will only increase. And I believe that for us to, you know, get the maximum benefit, we need to continue to do, you know, really well-informed research on where it's moving the needle. So we published a paper just this week on the impact of informed consent. We've worked with the Tufts Center for Drug Development on publishing the impact of DCT. When I fast forward 5 years, I think digital should go from that 65 to 100% of trials. But really, it's not just about the adoption, it's about the impact. What that should look like is a meaningful reduction in the time it is required, let's say as measured by the total number of months in phase two and phase three trials. It should also look like a meaningful reduction in the cost. And I think that, you know, in 5 years, we should start to see that signal. And in 10 years, it should look very different. We should be able to actually point to more drugs approved per year because we're taking more shots on goal, because the technology and the science has facilitated a new reality of what's possible.
Well, that's definitely the holy grail, isn't it, right there? That's the holy grail. Thank you, Michelle. Today, I was talking to Dr. Michelle Longmire, CEO and co-founder of woman-owned company, Medable. Join us for the next episode of Transperfect Lifestyle Talks. I'm Mark Wade. Bye-bye.